possible with support from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, with an international brunch, lunch, and new seasonal dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria now features Sunday dinner with a different and unique menu every week. Funds for this day of broadcasting come in part from a contribution by Alexis Tate in honor of her son Travis Tate on his 22nd birthday. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. When Abraham Lincoln ran for president, he had only served one term in Congress. That term was, as they say, undistinguished. He had also lost two campaigns for the U.S. Senate. But in May of 1860, he managed to best several better-known rivals and secure the Republican nomination for president. How was it that Abraham Lincoln rose from frontier prairie lawyer to become president, win the Civil War, and preserve the Union? Lincoln's political acuity is the subject of a new book by Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. Goodwin shows how Lincoln drew his rivals into the White House in order to help save the country. Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. And listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon. I welcome your questions and comments. You can join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use our toll-free line. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Doris Kearns Goodwin is the author of five books, including No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, The Homefront in World War II, for which she won the Pulitzer Prize. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Doris Kearns Goodwin, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. I'm delighted to be with you.
You begin your introduction with some words from Frederick Douglass, including this: "Any man can say things that are true of Abraham Lincoln, but no man can say anything that is new of Abraham Lincoln." But you found something to tell us that's new about Lincoln. What have you found?
Well, at first, when I started this project 10 years ago, I worried about the very fact that Douglass was talking about in 1876. Would there be anything new given how many books have been written about him? But it took about 2 years into the process, and I realized that there was this great story about these people, the team of rivals, as the title suggests, who had been against Lincoln in 1860 and then were brought into his cabinet and who became his advisors, in some cases his great friends and allies, and just his ability to transform former opponents into allies and partners seemed to me a wonderful story. And luckily, they had all kept diaries and wrote letters, so there was a real way of getting into the story intimately.
Yeah. You've said that when you began working on this book, you thought you'd concentrate on Abraham Lincoln and Mary Todd Lincoln, as you had with Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. How was it that you discovered the story to tell was that of Lincoln and the men who had been his rivals for the nomination in 1860?
You know, always I think what I try to do is to look back almost day to day of what it's like to live in that period of time. And when I started trying to piece together how Lincoln spent his day, I realized that he was spending more time with Seward, with Chase, with his war secretary, later Stanton, than he was with Mary Lincoln. And as I began to think about him waiting in the telegraph office for the news of what the battles had been, or going to visit the soldiers, or going to Seward's house, I would find relaxing almost every other night, or taking a carriage ride with him in the afternoon, that's when I realized, I think, how much a role they were playing in his daily White House life. Hmm. And that's when I said, yes, these are the guys I want to write about.
Yeah. What do you enjoy more, the research or the telling of the story?
Well, I think in some ways, you know, what I like to think of myself as is a storyteller. I mean, I do think history in many ways, if you can tell it in the form of a story that has a beginning and a middle and an end, I remember reading much, much long ago an essay by Barbara Tuchman, a great historian, who said, even if you're writing about a war, you have to imagine to yourself you do not know how that war ended, so you can carry your reader with you every step along the way from beginning to middle to end. In other words, tell them a story that has a beginning and an ending. And the research is the way of making that story hopefully come alive for the reader.
Yeah. I've got a couple of other questions here I want to ask at the outset, and then we already have a listener waiting to talk with us. So let me ask the following questions. By way of telling the story, you open the story. It's Springfield, Illinois, May 1860. Lincoln is at work in his law office, and he's nervous. He believes he's got an outside chance to win the nomination. A couple of questions here. What led Lincoln to pursue the nomination for president for the Republican Party, and how did he pull it off?
Well, the amazing thing is one would have thought after he had had only one single term in Congress and two times he tried for the Senate and two times he failed that he might have said, well, maybe I better go into another line of work. But somehow he had enough confidence in himself. And he knew that during his debates with Stephen Douglas in 1858, he had made a national reputation. Douglas, everybody thought, would be the Democratic nominee, which he was for president in 1860. So the fact that Lincoln had been able to best him or at least equal him in those debates made him already a national figure. And then what he understood was that even though he wasn't probably the first choice of most of the delegations outside of Illinois, that if he deliberately tried to become the second choice of all of them in case their own first choice failed, and if he didn't disparage any of his other rivals the way they were all running around disparaging each other, then he had a dark horse chance. And that's exactly what happened. Plus, he stood in the middle of the party. Plus, the convention was held in Chicago, which he actually had something to do with. Everybody else wanted it in their own states. And he had his guy say, well, there's no real front runner in Illinois. Let's have it in Chicago. And then he could pack the hall with his supporters, which helped with momentum.
Yeah, and they've always done that, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the big thing that's different from today, obviously, is that the candidates are not there. You know, they're all waiting, as you suggested, nervously in their home states for the news by telegraph that they have won or lost.
Yeah. Let's talk with this listener now who's waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah. Ms. Goodwin, I guess I have a problem, and the problem is in taking now any of your work seriously, because it's been documented you're a plagiarist. Now, you have blamed this on your research assistants, which is, you know, the easiest dodge in the world for any author. But how can anyone here in your listening audience or anywhere else take you seriously when it has been documented now that you are a plagiarist and you have refused to accept responsibility for your plagiarism? Indeed, this goes way back to the days when you were at Harvard and you submitted your tenure piece at Harvard and apparently did not bother to disclose to anyone that you had written that in conjunction with your husband. So that's the problem I have when I hear you on radio programs or see you on television programs, that you're just a plagiarist. Thank you.
Well, sir, number one, I absolutely took responsibility. I don't know where you're saying that from. I acknowledged it in writing. I acknowledged it everywhere I went. It was not my researchers. It was my own problem. The mistakes were inadvertent. And in fact, a group of historians, including Arthur Schlesinger and the major historians, wrote a letter to the New York Times saying it was not plagiarism because plagiarism requires intent. There's no way I could have intended to take anyone else's words when I had a footnote to that person every step along the way. So you're mistaken in what you're thinking. But if you want to keep thinking that and having the wrong kinds of information, that's up to you.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the story of a team of rivals. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, our guest this afternoon here on the program. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners can join us with questions, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's go back to the rivals. Who were the rivals for the nomination, in the Republican nomination in 1860?
Well, the major one who I think was the one that I felt the most close to was William Henry Seward, because everybody thought he was the person who should have won the nomination. The governor and senator from New York, he He had been the key anti-slavery orator during the 1850s. So certain were people that he would win that 10,000 people had gathered outside his home in Auburn, New York. The champagne had already been uncorked. And then they thought if he didn't win, then the next person would be Salmon Chase of Ohio, who had also been a governor and senator and a great anti-slavery force in the 1850s. If not Chase, they thought it would be Edward Bates, who was an elder statesman from Missouri and had had a very honored career. And as each one of these were really colorful, interesting characters, many of them more interesting than almost anyone that might appear on the scene today, and yet Lincoln somehow bests them all, which makes the great story.
Yeah. At the time of this campaign for the nomination, what did the rivals think of Lincoln?
Not too much. I mean, they didn't know much about him. Seward had met him once in 1848 when they were both campaigning for Zachary Taylor in Massachusetts. And they had actually spent a night together talking in Worcester and in Boston. And Chase had not met him up till that point, but thought that how could this little Illinois lawyer beat me out? And Bates had met him a couple times, thought he was pretty competent, a decent man, but certainly not up to the job of being president. So clearly each one of them thought they should have been president instead of Lincoln, and they were far more educated, far more, they had college degrees, Phi Beta Kappas, much more privileged backgrounds than Lincoln had had. So they really felt the wrong man had been chosen.
Yeah. Can you give us some sense of the sting, the shock that Lincoln's nomination caused these men?
Well, I remember Seward said that he walked around the street the next day after he heard the shocking news, and everybody was so solicitous toward him. He said he almost felt as if he were hearing his obituary, that he had died, and that he had somehow, he was telling him how badly they felt, and Chase couldn't believe it. But then the huge, even greater shock was not simply that he had been nominated. In fact, even the newspaper guys were calling him by the wrong name, calling him Abram rather than Abraham at first, and he finally had to write in and say, my name is really Abraham. But then the shock was that he put these people into his cabinet. I mean, it was an unprecedented act at the time, especially since they all thought so little of him at the moment.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Aurora on line 2. Hi.
Hi, Doris. I feel I know you. Can I call you by your first name?
Of course you can. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, I just love you.
Thank you.
Every time there's something presidential, I always hope you're on to give your remarks about what's going on. I've read all your books except Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. I love No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. That book was just great. And you're on the radio now. Is there a book coming out?
Well, what I'm talking about right now is the one that I just published this last few months ago on Abraham Lincoln, and it's called Team of Rivals. And in some ways really was, I think, my favorite book. I started the process liking him and respecting him, but came away in many ways feeling this enormous affection for him.
Well, I used to make a promise to myself every February to read a book about Lincoln. I haven't done it the last couple of years, I'm sorry to say, but I will read yours. How about that?
I would love it if you did. That would be great. Thank you.
Thanks for
the Team of Rivals.
That's what it's called.
Team of Rivals.
The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln.
Okay. I want to thank the listener for the call. Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. The publisher is Simon & Schuster. Next, we go to a listener in Piatt County. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I read Gore Vidal's Lincoln, was it?
Right, exactly.
I just picked it up and grabbed it. And I think the problem with that is that it's just so much a novel. And I found myself wanting, you know, because it was so intriguing, and he takes all these minor characters and creates characters and points of view, and so you get something that's, you know, Gore Vidal. And so I just want to say I bought your book on the basis of how much I enjoyed No Ordinary Time, and I haven't started it yet. And I'm going to start it this afternoon, and I'm just so glad to have a researched version now. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. You know, and the interesting thing is that what interested Gore Vidal, which are these relationships with Seward and Chase and Chase's daughter, Kate Chase, also are at the core of what interested me. So But this time there are quotes. You know, it does have primary sources. It uses letters. It uses diaries. So it's based in history. But hopefully the characters come alive, because I thought Fidel's focus was really the right focus in a lot of ways.
I want to thank the listener for her call. And while we're on the subject of other books about Lincoln, what do you think of Joshua Wolfshank's work, Lincoln's Melancholy?
Well, I think he's done a really interesting job in showing not simply the melancholy temperament that Lincoln had, but more importantly, the resources he brought to bear to soothe himself out of his sad moods. I mean, I came away feeling that once he got into the presidency, there really is no evidence of any severe depression, that there had been a depressive episode when he was young and when he was worrisome and the friends were fearful that he might even be suicidal, but he pulled himself out of that. And then after that, it does seem he has this melancholy temperament, but not that he's got some deep-seated depression, because once he's in the presidency, there's no evidence of his ever being dysfunctional, taking to his bed. I mean, he's sad. There are reasons to be sad during that period of time, but he's often the one that sustains everyone else's spirits through his humor, through his ability to get away when he needed to and go to the theater to relax and go visit the soldiers when things were tough, and he would bolster their morale and let them bolster his back. So I agree with Shank's idea that the interesting thing is the creative ways he dealt with it, even more so than the underlying sadness.
Hmm. Back to the rivals, Seward, Chase, Bates. After the nomination, after the election, when did Lincoln approach them for joining his cabinet?
Pretty soon, actually. I mean, what happens is after his election in November, the southern states begin right away to secede from the Union. So he knows that the nation is in peril, and he knows, as he later said, that these are the strongest men in the nation, and he needs them on his side. So the first one he goes to is Seward, knowing that he's the most important one to get, and the Secretary of State role is considered the premier role at that time. And then they come to visit him, the other ones do, in Springfield. So Chase comes, and they stay at the hotel right there, and then Bates comes and stays at the hotel, and Thurlow Weed, who is the boss of New York and Seward's great friend, comes and visits Lincoln. And he's working the whole thing out. It doesn't get fully worked out as to who's going to get what job until actually right before his inauguration. But he's pretty much determined that he wants these three guys, I think, within weeks after he wins the election.
Mm. Seward became his Secretary of State, Chase of Treasury, and Bates Attorney General. Were there other powerful rivals within the party that he had to deal with other than those he was in opposition to for the nomination?
Well, the other person that he had to bring into his cabinet, in part, some people think, because a bargain was made at the convention, was Simon Cameron, who had been the boss of Pennsylvania. And Lincoln really didn't want to bring him into the cabinet. He does bring him in at that time as Secretary of War because he had somewhat of a reputation potentially for corruption, and Lincoln was so careful of his own honest reputation. But it seemed like it had been promised, perhaps, that if Pennsylvania came to Lincoln, that someone from Pennsylvania would get a major role, and it seemed like it should be Cameron. And it was one of the mistakes he made. In fact, within a year of his appointing Cameron, Cameron was let go, and he brought in the great Edwin Stanton to take his place.
Yeah, we'll talk about Stanton for sure in a moment or two, but Cameron was sent off to Russia, right?
That's correct. And in those days, you're really sent off when you go to Russia.
Now, the appointments, the nominations of these men to the cabinet, his former rivals, what did that signal to the observers on the scene in Washington at the time?
Well, I think at first, you know, we look at it now as a signal of strength because he would have enough confidence to put these people in, even though they were better known than he was. But at the time, my guess is that people thought, well, maybe he's just going to be a figurehead president, and Seward, for example, will really be running the show. And I think that's what Seward thought at the start as well, so that it wasn't clear what Lincoln was doing when he did that, although later people give him great credit for making that decision.
Mm. Now, these were not the only rivals he would approach. He also named some Democrats or former Democrats to the cabinet. Tell us about them.
That's right. I mean, the Blair family had been very powerful in the middle states, in Tennessee and in Maryland, and in Missouri, and he named Montgomery Blair to become his postmaster general. And truly, they had been Democrats prior to this. They also became part of the founders of the Republican Party. I mean, the thing is that the Republican Party is so young at this time that it's made up of former Democrats, former Whigs, former nativists, and former radicals. And so by pulling all these different sorts together into his cabinet, it means that he's got all the factions in his official family that he needs to somehow mobilize. And it was such a smart thing to do because it meant he had to sharpen his thinking and question his own assumptions. And if he could keep these people working together as a team inside the tent, then maybe he could hold it together in the North as a whole.
Mm. Gideon Welles, he appointed Secretary of the Navy, and he was a good appointment as well, correct?
He was an excellent appointment. Gideon Welles, also a former Democrat, who was a great rival of Seward's. I mean, the thing is, they were not only rivals of each other in Lincoln's sense, but they hated one another. And he was a very, very good Navy secretary of character, as the way he looked. I mean, with this ridiculous beard and this huge white wig, but ended up being an excellent choice. And for historians, a wonderful choice, because he kept one of the best diaries during the whole Civil War, day after day after day, and he was a big gossip. Mm. So we learned a lot about what was going on inside the cabinet meetings.
Yeah. I read a book last week about the Navy during this period of our history, and I came away feeling with the impression that Gideon Welles hadn't been as competent for the Union as had been his Confederate counterpart. But this paints a different picture of Gideon Welles.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think when you think about the fact that so much of the people so many of the people who'd been in the top Navy posts and the admirals went off into the Confederacy, and that the Union lost most of its ports and most of its ships, it was almost as if Welles had to build a Navy from scratch. And it's true that some mistakes were made at the beginning when they lost the Norfolk Navy Yard, but after that, he systematically built up a Navy that really was able to run the blockade, which was a hugely important thing for the Union.
And also the size of the Navy, the U.S. Navy, grew by leaps and bounds.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, it really is like creating it from nothing. Oh, the Army, too. I mean, there were so few soldiers in the Army at the start, in the Union Army. And again, the best generals went to the Confederate side, so it was a much more of a hill to go up for the Union.
Okay. Well, let's bring the story up to 1862, and Simon Cameron is out. He's on his way to Russia. And Edwin Stanton becomes Secretary of War, succeeding Cameron. What should we know about Stanton?
Well, I think the amazing thing to know about Stanton and Lincoln's relationship is that Stanton had humiliated Lincoln when they were young lawyers together in 1855. They were thrown together on a big national case. The case was supposed to be tried in Illinois. Stanton came from Ohio, so he thought he needed somebody of counsel in Illinois. Somebody interviewed Lincoln. They make him of counsel. But then the case got transferred back to Ohio, and they no longer needed Lincoln, but they never told him. So he worked all summer on his brief. He was so excited at the thought of working with Stanton. He comes to Ohio and runs right up to Stanton in his typically affable way and said, "Let's go up to the courthouse together." And apparently Stanton took one look at him and saw that he had a stain on his shirt and his sleeves were too short and his trousers were too short. And he said to his partner, we've got to get rid of this long-armed ape. He will hurt our cause. So they turned their back on him, never opened the brief, didn't sit with him at the boarding house. And Lincoln left Cincinnati feeling really humiliated, wanting never even to go back to the city again. Yet, after Cameron fails in December of 1861, he's able to somehow put that grudge behind him and appoint Stanton war secretary, and he becomes historians would argue a great war secretary, and ends up loving Lincoln more than anyone outside of his own family. So it's an amazing transformation.
Yeah, how was it that these characters, William Seward and Edwin Stanton, how was it that they were able to overcome how they viewed Lincoln and become allies of the president?
I think the credit has to go to Lincoln's emotional strength. I mean, what he was able to do somehow was to give them respect, to make them each feel that he had a personal relationship with each of them. When something that he did went well, he shared the credit with them, which is always a good thing to do. When one of them screwed up, he took the blame for them, which they never would forget. He never dressed them down in public, and he had such an emotional ability to share his emotions that when things were tough, they knew he was there. They knew he had strength and faith in the cause, and they saw what an extraordinary speaker and writer he was, so they gradually came to understand his qualities. But I think mostly it was just the way he treated them. And when you think about politics, the great thing is that it's all about human relationships, and he understood that so well that he did bring each one of these. The only person who never gave up his hope to be president was Chase, who tried actually to run against him in 1864.
Yeah. Well, we've talked a little bit about Chase, and he's kind of still kind of fuzzy on this thing, but Cameron, who was not a good choice. The others that Lincoln selected that served, did they serve their president and the country well?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, the Interior Secretary didn't have all that much to do, but I think definitely each one of the other cabinet officers, one would say, did a very good job at what they were asked to do. And that's one of the reasons that Lincoln kept them on, even though he knew at the beginning that, some of them were questioning him. As long as they were doing their job well, that's what mattered to him. And in the end, the North did run their part of the war better than the South did in terms of the governing part of the process, which I think was part of the reason why they eventually won.
Mm. Historian Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine, the author of 5 books. The one we're talking about today is her latest, Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with some other listeners. Next, we go to Belgium, Illinois. Listener on line 4. Hi.
Good morning. Good afternoon. I was wondering if your guest there could talk about Lincoln's time as a railroad lawyer, because he actually did make some history in that he fought a case about the first bridge that went across the Mississippi River, if I remember right. And wasn't he somewhat disliked because some of the things he did as a railroad lawyer?
I don't know all that much about it. I mean, I do think you are right in the two things you've said, that there was an important case and that obviously there were people on the other side of these cases who disliked him for supporting the railroads. But he equally would take cases, runaway slave cases and slave owner cases, so that he saw himself as a lawyer's lawyer who would be on different sides of the question. And he did become a very substantial lawyer at that time in Illinois, so that meant that at times he was supporting corporations like the railroads. But since I was only dealing with the past of his in terms of its political impact, I haven't gone that much into it, but there's a lot of new research going on now about his legal career, and they're uncovering a lot more information about it. So I think it's going to become one of those new sources of understanding about Lincoln. But I wish I could help you more, but I don't know anymore.
Well, he did ride the circuit between Springfield, I think it was Springfield.
Oh, that I know. I love that period. I did get into because, again, I think it was an important formative part of his political career, because when he rode the circuit, he was with his fellow lawyers, and everywhere he went, when people knew he was in the town, they would come from miles around to listen to him tell stories. That was the way in which I think he began to interact with people and begin to build up this political following. They loved nothing more than listening to him standing in a boarding house with his back against the fire, and he would talk for 3 or 4 hours. It was an amazing thing. So that part of the legal circuit and a lot of the friends that he formed, Judge Davis, who was the judge, becomes his campaign manager in 1860, and a whole series of them stay his closest friends through the rest of his life. So I know that part of the legal career. What I didn't go into were the actual cases itself.
I see. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign on line 1. Hi.
Hi. I'm sort of a news junkie, even though I'm an old nurse. Anyhow, my question is this. During the 20th century, I had the news hour last night. They suggested that FDR was the man of choice, the president of choice, and Lincoln was the president of choice in the 19th century. My question is, you do agree with that, Doris, and thank you so much for this program.
I do think if we had to choose you know, the great president of the 20th century, it would be FDR, and of the 19th, it would be Lincoln, and then George Washington probably, if we went to the century before. You know, it's impossible. Sometimes people ask me to rate these presidents vis-a-vis one another, and it's really hard to because the challenges they faced were so different. But there's no question that the Civil War was probably one of the greatest challenges of the country, which Lincoln met, and then World War II and the Depression, which Roosevelt met. And they share certain qualities. They both, Roosevelt and Lincoln, understood how to shape and mold public opinion and how to feel the current of public opinion and move step by step toward the goals that they wanted to reach. I would have loved to have seen those two characters talking to each other.
Mm. You mentioned that his gift for storytelling. What kind of stories did he favor, and is there a story that he liked to tell that you could tell?
Well, you know, I think what he favored were stories that often made a point that, you know, if something were being discussed, he had this almost computerized ability to bring out, oh, that reminds me of a story, and then it might soothe the tensions that were being discussed at the cabinet, or if somebody was put on the spot, it would make him able to laugh at himself and take the tension off the other person. And some of them are too crude for television or for radio. I mean, it's the kind you told in the boarding houses. We would be bleeped if we told them, but they're really funny. I mean, there's a great... And then sometimes, as I say, they'd be... Like, for example, in 1864, when Grant had been made the commander of the Union armies and was doing really well, and Lincoln, meanwhile, won the nomination to be the Republican nominee again, and somebody came to him and said... You know, everything's set. You're going to be the next president unless Grant takes Richmond, and then he'll be so popular that he will then probably win the Democratic nomination and beat you for the presidency. So Lincoln says, you know, I feel like you're a doctor, and you've just told me that I have a fatal disease. Now, I don't really want to die, but if I'm going to die, that's the disease I'd like to die from. Let Grant take Richmond, in other words.
Mm, yeah.
So, I mean, he just was able to spike any kind of embarrassing moment with that humor of his, and it was a wonderful resource.
That's a great lesson to take from this story, isn't it?
Oh, I think so, absolutely. You know, what it means is not taking yourself so seriously. I remember my husband, who worked for John Kennedy, remembers that during the 1960 campaign, at one point, they went somewhere in West Virginia. It was really cold, and they were supposed to have breakfast with a whole group of people, and nobody showed up. And instead of just being humiliated and embarrassed, John Kennedy said, you know, if I were these people, I wouldn't come to see me today either. Let's go have some breakfast. You know, and then it just takes the onus off the staff who might have felt badly that they didn't advance it well. You just have to laugh at yourself at certain moments.
Yeah, yeah. The political climate today, though, is so different.
Oh, and the big difference, too, is that Lincoln knew that if he did make a mistake, he would acknowledge it. And then you learn from it. You know, at one point somebody said about that he supposedly said, I'd like to believe I'm smarter today than I was yesterday, which allows you to acknowledge that you did something that you might have done differently had you known everything you knew then. And it's so simple, but today it seems our politicians have so much difficulty acknowledging errors or feeling like they're weak to do it, or we put them up to a standard during the campaign. You know, they said this thing 20 years ago, now they're saying something different now. And it's crazy. They can change their mind.
Yeah. Could a president today do what Lincoln did in creating this cabinet of rivals? Has any other president come close to doing something similar?
Well, Roosevelt did bring in, on the eve of World War II, two Republicans for key posts, Stimson and Knox. And Knox had actually been the vice presidential candidate against him in 1936. And then we've had sort of token people from the other party, like Bill Cohn was in Clinton's administration. But here it would be like putting in John McCain into Bush's cabinet and Al Gore, you know, or the real people that had been running against him at a certain time. And I think the difficulty now is, first of all, the campaigns are so personally attacking that the anger that's generated on the side of each side is so great that it would be hard for them to have that forgiving nature that Lincoln had. And if we knew what the people in Lincoln's cabinet were saying against each other, if that were on the nightly news every night or on the radio, it would probably make it very difficult for us to not be focused entirely. I mean, think about what we've been watching in the Olympics when two guys in speed skating have said a few things about each other, and that becomes the major story. What Danton and Seward and Chase were saying about each other, they'd call each other traitor, they wouldn't go to each other's offices, you know. They were having real fights, which would become fodder for everyday news.
Yeah, what were the cabinet meetings like?
They were pretty wild. So that's why we're so grateful to Gideon Welles, because he did really relate, as did Chase, what went on in these meetings. I mean, actually, inside the meetings, they would be pretty calm with each other, although sometimes right afterwards, one of them would walk out and catch Lincoln's attention or say something to one of them, I can't stand this other guy and I'm never going to listen to him again. And sometimes they wouldn't even come to the meeting if they knew the other guy was there. So it was pretty emotional.
Mm. You set out to write a book about the Lincoln's marriage, and you know, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems history has been dismissive of Mary Todd Lincoln. What are your thoughts about her?
I agree that I think history has been unfairly dismissive of her. You know, I think what happens is we look from the end backwards and know that at the end of her life she was very sad, understandably so. Out of four children, three had died young. One, Eddie, at 3 years old, little Willie in the middle of the Civil War at 10, Tad, the youngest one, at 18, and so she's left with this one son, Robert Todd Lincoln, who eventually puts her into an insane asylum, which she gets herself out of in a very short order because she really probably wasn't insane. And yet, knowing that, we somehow project that back onto her old past. And when she first met Lincoln, I'm convinced she was very well suited to him. She was feisty. She wrote politics. She loved politics. She loved poetry. And I love the story she tells when they first met. He came up to her and saw her surrounded by beaux in her sister's mansion on the hill and said, you know, I want to dance with you, Mary, in the very worst way. And then she laughingly said, and he certainly did. And I think then they became partners. She believed in him. She could have married somebody with more money since she came from that. But she believed he had a future. But once she got to the White House, there was just no room for them to be partners anymore. And she was focused on redecorating the White House, which was a noble goal in a way because she wanted it as a symbol of the Union. But what happened is any money that was spent on curtains and draperies and rugs seemed frivolous at a time when the soldiers needed blankets, as Lincoln later said. And then she loses Willie. And then I think she really does lose her will to live.
Yeah.
The sad thing is that at the very end, on the very last day of his life, he takes her on a carriage ride and says to her, you know, knowing that the war is now coming to a successful end, you know, Mary, we've just got to try and be happier. Between Willie's death and the war, we've been so unhappy. And they begin to plan trips they might want to make to the Holy Land, to the Rocky, over the Rockies, to California, and to Europe. And you begin to hope that maybe they'll regain some of the spirit of that earlier days of their marriage. And then, of course, that's the night that he's killed.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Historian Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest this afternoon here on the program. Let's talk with one more listener before we run out of time. Listener on a cell phone, line 4, go ahead. Line 4?
Hello, yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm reading the book, Team of Rivals, and I'm moved by the towards the end of the book, when Fremont is having a convention and only 400 people show up, and then he immediately, that reminds him of a passage in the Bible, and he turns directly to that. I'd like to hear your comments on that. That just, that kind of recollection and that kind of genius that he has, and I wondered if you felt similar.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think what's so extraordinary about Lincoln is that even though he didn't read widely because he only had 1 year of formal schooling, the books that he did read as a young man, it's almost like he memorized them and could call them forth. And they were some of the best books in English literature, the Bible, the King James Version of the Bible, Aesop's Fables, Shakespeare's plays, great poetry. So that somehow it almost seems like we educate our kids so broadly, but he educated himself so deeply, exactly as you suggest, he could call out one of these passages either from Shakespeare or the Bible whenever he needed it, almost as if his brain could turn it right on.
Mm. Before we have to say goodbye this afternoon, I would like it very much if you would talk about the cast of female characters other than Mary that you bumped up against in your research.
Oh, absolutely.
On this book.
I mean, Seward's wife, Frances, really an interesting woman, brilliant, intellectual, much more of an abolitionist than her husband, always telling him what should be done instead of what could be done. He submitted his his speeches to her, and she went over them all. One of those women, unfortunately, who had so much talent, and the 19th century didn't give her the room to exercise that talent. So she really interested me. Her daughter, Fanny, at 16 years old, decides she wants to be a writer. So she keeps a diary, decides she will not marry because she didn't think you could combine the two, keeps this wonderful diary until the age of 21 when the war comes to an end, and then she dies of tuberculosis. And then Salmon Chase's daughter, Kate, whom he sends to a boarding school when she's 7 for 10 years in New York to train her to become really his surrogate wife because he's lost 3 wives young, one at childbirth, 22, another at 25, another in her early 30s. So Kate becomes the love of his life. And she emerges as what people think of as the most fascinating young woman of her time, is his campaign manager, his political partner. She runs a rival court to marry where all the people come and gather. And she ends up marrying a very wealthy older man, really just to further her father's political ambitions, and it ends up very sadly. But these women are, and Mary, of course, too, they, you know, 19th century, sometimes the men would write history and not mention the wives. And they're critical to all of these stories, including Edward Bates's wife, who he loved so much that it diminished his own political ambitions because he didn't want to be away from her. And they ended up having 17 children, so he wasn't away from her very long.
You know, it sounds to me that there's so much out there. You know, I think we might feel a little bit like if I was a historian or studying history, maybe I'd feel like a little bit like the sentiment that Frederick Douglass expressed. We can't find anything that's new, and it seems like there is just such richness out there yet to be.
Oh, I think so. I think especially, you know, that's where all the new research in women's history, I think, is coming to fruit, because there's so many diaries that women left, letters that they wrote to their families that shed light on the power of guys, but on their own family lives as well, which I think will really be opening us to new doors on the past and the future.
Mm. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Yes, hello there. Hi, Doris.
Hello.
I saw you last weekend in Springfield, Illinois at the book signing, and I wanted to ask you if you were able to tour the new Lincoln Presidential Museum, what your thoughts about it were. I think it's superb, but I would like to hear your comment.
I agree with you totally. I had a wonderful tour for a few hours in the next morning, and I think they've just done a terrific job to bring a person, once they come in, through Lincoln's life and make it really come alive and make him seem like a person and not simply a monument. And I like very much that it's got a lot of modern equipment in it so that younger generations will be able to connect to it. I mean, that's the great thing a museum can do, I think, is to foster a love of history in people. I remember when I was only 7 years old and went to the Roosevelt Library in Hyde Park, and I saw his glasses on his desk, and I said to my parents, he can't be dead. He's got to come back and get his glasses. You know, he left them there. And I remember feeling his presence in that place. And I think when people come through the Lincoln Museum now, they're going to feel Lincoln's presence, and that's a great accomplishment.
Thanks for the call. Let's take one more call. Listener in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Hi. Doris, a quick question. We're on short time. Annually at the Marxist Scholars Conference, there's always a discussion in the cloakrooms about the missing correspondence between Karl Marx and Abraham Lincoln. And for our listeners, Karl Marx was a regular correspondent for the New York Times. Frederick Douglass, of course, was a member of the First International, the International Working Man's Association. And this is always a subject of debate. Do you know anything about that? And I'll let you go. Thank you very much for taking my call.
No, I too have heard that there is some correspondence, but have never been able to find it or see it. I mean, there is a famous speech that Lincoln gives where he talks about labor being prior to capital. And I think that's one of those speeches that makes working men and people who care about labor unions and people who care about labor really sing because of that speech. So I think his instincts to care about everybody should have a right, no matter where they're born, to rise to the level of their talents and the discipline wherever it will take them, and that's what the idea of America was supposed to be about, is something that would really be celebrated, I think, by working men all over the world.
Mm. And the caller is correct. We're out of time. Historian Doris Kearns Goodwin has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Her latest book is Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, the publisher Simon & Schuster. Doris, thank you very much.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. It is 10 minutes before 2 o'clock. Todd Gleason is going to join us here in just a moment with settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade. Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri-Energy in Palestine, Illinois, producing a renewable fuel with corn bought directly from the farmer. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at LincolnLandAgriEnergy.com. Here now is Todd Gleason.
Thanks much. The last from the Chicago Board of Trade on this Wednesday afternoon. Futures finish the day like this. The wheat pit anywhere between 5 and 7 cents lower in Chicago. Corn off 2 to 4 for the day. And the beans were down 13 to 14 and a half cents for the day. In Kansas City, the nearby wheat traded the March contract 8 and a half cents lower with a high today of 439 and a half and a low at 431 and a quarter. Their settlement price a quarter above that, down 8 and a half cents for the March wheat in Kansas City. May futures were down 7 cents at 439, their high at 45, the low at 37 for the day. From the wheat pit in Chicago, nearby soft red winter wheat off 7 cents today, 372 the high, the low at 362. Settlement price at 365 and a half. Once again, they were down 7. May futures at 384 and a half high, low at 373 and a half. Settled at 377 and a half, down 6 and a half. In July contract, 394 and a half the high, the low at 83 and a half. Settlement price at 387 and a quarter, and they finished 6 cents lower. September futures 401 the high, the low at 393 and a half. Settlement price at 397 and a quarter, down 6 and a quarter. In December wheat 414 the high, low at 405. Settlement price at 408. They were down 6 cents. The March contract down 5 and a half at 416 and one half. From the corn pit in Chicago, March contract 226 the high, the low at 221. Settled at $2.21 a bushel, down 4.5 cents. The May futures down 4.5 today, 237 the high, the low at 32. Settlement price at 32.5, off 4.5 of the May contract. And July futures from the corn pit, 246 the high, low at 41.5. Settlement price at 41.75. They were down 4.25 for the day. September's 252 the high, low at 48.5. Settlement price at 248.75, down 3.25. And the December contract, 261.5 the high, the low at 58.25. Settlement price at $2.59 and a quarter. They were off 2.5 cents. March futures, 267.25 on the high, low at $2.64 and 3/4. Settlement price at 265.25, down 2.25. And the May contract at 269.5 high, low at 67.5. Settlement price at 68. And they finished down 2 cents for the day. Oat pit now, March contract, a 189.5 high, low at 186.5, settled at 187.75. They were up 3/4 in the May oats, down 1 cent, 191 the high, the low at 88.75, settlement price at 189.25. Soy complex, March beans, 585.5 the high, the low at 73, settlement price at 74. They were down 13.5 today. The May futures off 14.5. 598 the high, the low at 85, settlement price at $5.86.5, down 14.5 in the nearby May contract for the soybeans. July futures 608 the high, the low at 596, settlement price at 598 and a quarter. They were off 12. The August down 12 as well for the day. 606.5 the high, the low at 601, settlement price there in the August down 12 cents at 601, same as the low. September futures 607.5 the high, the low and settlement price both at 603, they were down a dime. And November futures a 616 high, low at 607.5, they managed a little bit of a bounce, 608 and 3/4, they were down 11 and 3/4 by the end of the day. And the January 620 the high, the low at 13. Settlement price at 615 and 3/4 were off a dime. March bean meal, 179.50, the high, the low at 175.30. Settled at 180.20, down 4.70. And the May bean meal, 181.20, the high, the low at 177.10. Settlement price at 182.20, down 4.70. And the March bean oil for the day, 23.07, the high, the low at 22.65. Their settlement price at 22.75. There we're down 30 for the day. In the May futures, 23.45 the high, the low at 23.03. Settlement price at 23.14. And they finished down 35. Celeste, during the closing market report this afternoon, we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. We'll get an update on what's been happening in the state of Illinois on the tax situation with timberland, as many farmers and other landowners may know. Their taxes for real estate on timbered land may go up dramatically in this coming year. That's because a new law will be an old law will be enforced finally this year. We'll take a look at those things during the closing market report this afternoon. And right now, I think you've got a look at the Mercantile Exchange.
I do, and livestock prices were mixed today. Feeder cattle finished higher, live cattle were mixed, lean hogs were lower, and February bellies finished on the upside. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Bastifer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, and equal housing lender. Okay, and here now are the numbers. March feeder cattle, the high 108.20, the low 107.80, the settlement 107.90, that up 27.5. April 108.50, the high 108.05, the low 108.30, the settlement, that finishing up 45. May feeder cattle 109.05, the high 108.60, the low 108.92.5, the settlement, that up 42.5. February live cattle 91 even, the high, the low 90.50, the settlement 90.62.5, that up 7.5. April live cattle 88.82.5, the high 88.15, the low 88.20, the settlement, that down 27.5. April lean hog 63.20, the high 61.30, the low, the settlement today 62.02.5, that down 122.5. May 68.20, the high 66.60, the low 67.40, the settlement, that down 92.5. June lean hog 70.50, the high 68.85, the low 70.12.5, the settlement, that down 60. July 68.20, the high 66.55, the low 68.15, the settlement, that down 17.5. And February bellies 89.05, the high, the low 84.55, finishing out the day today at 88.60, that up 2.55. The Dow is currently up 70 points at 11,139, the NASDAQ up 21 at 2283, and the S&P 500 is up 9 points at 1292. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. 2 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, 49 degrees in Urbana. Let's take a look at Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. In northern and central sections, mostly sunny. In the south, a mix of clouds and sunshine. Highs ranging from 38 in northwestern Illinois to 52 in the metro east area of St. Louis. Tonight, clear to partly cloudy with lows ranging from 22 in northwestern Illinois to 32 in the far south. Tomorrow, north, partly sunny with a chance of a few flurries during the afternoon. In central and southern sections, mostly sunny. Highs ranging from 35 in northwestern Illinois to 57 in the far south. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, mostly sunny. The high, 48. Winds shifting from southwesterly to northwesterly at 7 to 14 miles per hour. Tonight, clear. The low, 28. Winds westerly to southwesterly at 6 to 12 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and breezy. The high, 46, with winds out of the west at 12 to 24 miles per hour. 48 degrees now in Urbana on the campus of the University of